Hi, I'm Jessica Steinberg. Welcome to the Times of Israel Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world.
Hi, everyone. Today is Monday, October 4th. I'm Jessica Steinberg. My guests today at the Times of Israel Daily Briefing are diplomatic correspondent Laizer Berman and political writer Tal Schneider. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Jessica.
Good morning.
Okay, Laizer, you were out of the country again in Bahrain, I believe, last week with Foreign Minister Yair Lapid. He was there to do several things, including inaugurating the Israeli embassy. What else was happening on this diplomatic visit?
Sure. So this was a quick visit. We flew out of Ben Gurion Airport at 7 in the morning and got back 12:30 a.m. Friday morning. So we didn't sleep there, unlike the trips to open the office in Morocco and to open the embassy in the UAE. This was a much quicker trip, but it was jam-packed from start to finish. And you could really sense that the Bahrainis were going above and beyond to signal their excitement, to signal their enthusiasm about this relationship. So it was noticeably warmer than the already quite warm visits to UAE and Morocco. Like you said, the main centerpiece of this visit was officially opening the Israeli embassy in Manama, in the capital, in the Bahrain World Trade Center, the 29th floor. So that's the iconic building in the downtown Manama. It's kind of these two buildings connected with these kind of bridges type things in the middle. So that was in the evening. Before that, Lapid met with the foreign minister, Abdellatif Al-Zayani, and then he met with the crown prince and with the king of Bahrain. So that was noticeable that that came together. And in the days before, it wasn't entirely certain that he would get to meet with the king. But I think the main part of the visit, which kind of slipped under the radar initially, was the visit that we took to the base of the U.S. Fifth Fleet. So that's the U.S. fleet, U.S. Central Command's naval forces that operate in the Persian Gulf, in the Indian Ocean, in the Red Sea. So this is the naval force that's been confronting Iran for many, many years. And it was somewhat unprecedented where you have Israel, Israel's foreign minister with his Arab counterpart in an Arab country meeting in such a clearly military environment. So they went onto the USS Pearl Harbor, which is a big, it's certainly not the biggest U.S. ship there, but it was a big amphibious warfare ship. They met the commander of the U.S. Fifth Fleet, Vice Admiral Brad Cooper, America's top diplomat, Maggie Nardi was there as well. So it was a clear signal. The pictures were very clear to Iran that even though there is a sense and a belief that the U.S. is withdrawing its presence in the Middle East, and in many ways it is. Obviously, the Afghanistan withdrawal is the main exhibit for that. That the U.S. is signaling that it still has its allies back, that there is a real determination amongst these three countries and other countries as well to push back on Iran. And let's not forget that this takes place as there is unclarity about the future of the talks in Vienna. So it's unclear if they're going to continue at all. I believe that they will continue, but the likelihood of a deal is looking smaller and smaller every day. So this is a clear signal to Iran that they're not, they can't start planning for a U.S.-free future in the region. And even though some Gulf Arab states are indeed talking to Iran, there is a real alliance and a real emerging framework for pushing back on Iran. And again, this took place on a military base in front of a military ship, so that the hints there are quite clear to everyone who's seen those pictures.
Was that a surprise?
It wasn't a surprise in that it didn't happen. You know, they took us to some location. Surprise, we're at the naval base. We found out about that hours beforehand. Lapid certainly knew about it, but there was an embargo on reporting about it until it actually happened. But it's a surprise in general that that came together, and we haven't seen similar scenes like that in the past. And it's obviously a very clear signal from all sides, especially the United States.
Tal, you are heading to the Knesset today, or you're certainly writing about the opening session of the Knesset today. What are your expectations for today and what that will all look like?
So if our listeners remember, we had quite a summer with wakeful nights during June, July, and August, where the opposition led by the former Prime Minister Netanyahu was very forceful and did not let the coalition pass anything without sleepless hours. We do expect that to come back. We don't know how forceful they will be, but they will definitely give lots of troubles. The coalition is very narrow, 61 seats, and is very complicated. It has the Islamic movement led by Mansour Abbas, the Meretz and Labor, you know, lefty liberals, and all the way to the right wing of Naftali Bennett and Ayelet Shaked, the Yemina party, who is now the prime, obviously Naftali Bennett, the prime minister. So it's very complicated. We just saw a glimpse of that yesterday when two ministers from Meretz, Tamar Zandberg and Nitzan Horvitz. He is actually the health minister and she is the environmental protection minister. Both of them traveled to Ramallah to meet with the leader of the Palestinian Authority, the president, Mahmoud Abbas, not to confuse with Mansour Abbas, obviously.
Never.
They traveled to Ramallah. And over there, the president of the Palestinian Authority told them, I'm willing to meet with any minister of Israel, including I would love to meet with Ayelet Shaked, the interior minister. And she came out immediately in a tweet saying, forget about that. He's a Holocaust denier. I will never sit with him. That's just a glimpse to show you the diversity of this very, very weird government. And with that background and, you know, a whole disagreements about, you know, so many issues, they are supposed to pass bills, they are supposed to pass the budget and so on. I think the budget, which will come by next month, is their biggest test. Everybody keeps saying that it will pass, but I expect the opposition, again, led by the former Prime Minister Netanyahu, I expect them to try to find any kind of, you know, hole in this group to just dismantle everything. As of now, we don't see this government collapsing, but, you know, who knows?
Tal, this is sort of a question, obviously, from someone I have not spent certainly much time in the Knesset, or not for many years. But what's it like generally on the floor with, in other words, all these different personalities, all these different political parties and opinions? What's it like when they're actually hanging out there?
We were actually banned from the galley or the press galley for more than a year because of COVID restrictions. We went back to the galley last June to see this government swearing in, and we actually could see these fellows talk to each other, you know, from a close distance, about probably, I guess, 20 feet or so. And I have to tell you, it's quite interesting to see the right-wing people like Avigdor Lieberman or Ayelet Shaked, as I said, you know, Avigdor Lieberman, the finance minister, and the prime minister, Naftali Bennett, all coming from the very far right wing, you know, chiming with the Islamic movement politicians, or being, you know, very friendly. You can watch Gideon Saar, the justice minister, sits together with the, you know, labor minister, Merav Mikhaeli. This is like a social democrats, or, Meretz is the Greens, you know, being close to each other, consulting on issues. It's really an extraordinary time in Israel politics. Some people call it, by the way, the great social experiment. I think, even President Biden, when he met Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett a couple of weeks ago, kind of mentioned this is a social experiment in an era of polarized society influenced by, you know, social media. To see, you know, we don't know if the experiment is successful yet, you know?
Right. Have to wait and see. Okay. We'll be waiting to hear what you have to write about it.
This Times of Israel podcast is brought to you by Koren Publishers Jerusalem. Whether you're looking to enrich your mind or your soul, Koren Publishers has it all. From Israeli history to the works of Rabbi Sacks, Rabbi Steinsaltz, and other contemporary thinkers, including the brand new Magamon edition Koren Tanakh, with translation by Rabbi Sacks, Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Weinreb, Jessica Sacks, and many others. Times of Israel listeners can get 10% off your entire order. Just go to korenpub.com and use the code TOIPOD, that's KORENPUB.com, and enter the code TOIPOD for your 10% discount.
Laser, well, really for both of you, big headlines broke last night about the Pandora Papers, the nearly 12 million files that were obtained from 14 different firms located around the world, naming several prominent Israelis and Jordan's King Abdullah. So, Laser, why don't you comment on that first? And Tal, obviously, we're happy to hear what you have to say about that as well.
Sure. So the Pandora Papers, like you said, this massive leak, this massive trove of documents published by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. And it focuses on financial secrecy around the world, tax evasion, tax loopholes, and the like. Now, very relevant for Israel is the revelations about Jordan's King Abdullah. And the revelations are that he owns, personally, $100 million or so worth of property around the world, including the Malibu Coast, including Washington, D.C., including very expensive areas of London. And why is this relevant? Jordan is a country that receives billions of dollars over the years of aid from the United States and from the West. The economy is in a very problematic situation. Without external aid from the West, the regime would not survive. And now we see that the king is amassing this massive personal fortune that he is not telling people about. It is certainly a problem. And it's certainly a problem in the wake of two major events in the last decade. First, the Arab Spring, in which protesters took to the streets and accused the king and his queen, Queen Rania, of stealing from the nation. And those protests were put down with violence. And then we had over the past, within the past year, there was the strange episode where the king's half-brother, Prince Hamza, and some people that were close to him were put under, he was put under house arrest, accusations that he was seeking to topple the king. And that certainly taps into this growing discontent, especially in Jordanian tribes, which traditionally served as the backbone of support for the king. So this is certainly not going to help his legitimacy. This is certainly going to add to the grumbling that the people are suffering. And this king with only partial legitimacy anyway is stealing from the kingdom with the help of his Palestinian inner circle. So this is relevant to Israel because the stability of the Jordanian regime is a national security matter. That's Israel's longest border. That's a border that the Jordanian government and military helps keep quiet. And relations were not great, to say the least, but under Netanyahu, and they have been improving with this new Lapid-Bennett government. But this is going to certainly add a wrinkle and is going to cause grumbling about donors to the kingdom and also residents of the kingdom. And I'll also say this also taps into this fury around the world, which has driven elections in many places, including the election of Donald Trump, that there's this elite that plays by different rules, that doesn't have to pay taxes, while the middle and lower classes are working hard, paying their fair share, and not able to get ahead. So this is certainly going to tap into that and is going to rekindle that anger, and it might have some serious consequences in terms of electoral politics moving forward.
What would this look like, essentially, going forward?
Sure. So the worst-case scenario is that this really kicks off a renewed protest movement against the king. This further undermines his legitimacy. And this feeds into the narratives that have fueled growing discontent with the king. And that could lead, not a very likely scenario in any way, but to some serious threats to the stability and the survival of the regime. That's the worst case scenario. Any instability of in the kingdom is an opening for extremist groups, for terrorist groups. And it's not something that Israel wants to see. Israel will do anything it can, as will the United States, to shore up the regime. Again, it is a central core of Israel's national security outlooks, Israel's national security doctrine, that its eastern border with Jordan remains quiet, remains secure. I'll just give one little anecdote. The Jordanian soldiers along the border, which every couple of hundred yards you have these soldiers, they're not facing Israel, right? Their backs are to Israel. They're facing into the kingdom because their job as Jordanian soldiers is to make sure there's no terrorists coming into Israel. So they're helping us with our work. We don't have many, we have a couple hundred soldiers, in the entire, brigade, the Bika brigade, along that huge border. There's only a few hundred soldiers. They're certainly not elite soldiers in any sense. That's, we're able to do that because the Jordanian soldiers are essential element in protecting Israel's eastern border, which again is not very far from Jerusalem, is not very far from population center. So this could be a serious matter for Israel.
That's a helpful image. Tal, I'd love to hear your thoughts because there were some prominent Israelis and politicians named, including former Jerusalem mayor, now Knesset member Nir Barkat. Thoughts about that? Just ruminations?
The papers revealed that Nir Barkat, who was also a very successful high-tech executive, he had his own company for many years, made a lot of money. He's one of Israel's richest, you know, maybe the richest politician, but, you know, he was also very rich to begin with before he became mayor of Jerusalem. Now, according to the revelation, he put some of his money in an, blind escrow by his brother instead of depositing the money in a blind escrow as the law demands. We don't really know yet if this is just an ethics problem or is it a criminal problem. We don't know that yet. It's too soon to tell. But I have to tell you that Nir Barkat has been very successful in his pursuit of the Likud top spot right after Netanyahu. We are not over Netanyahu. Netanyahu is still the opposition leader. But people in the Likud, it's the biggest party in the Knesset, 29 seats. People in that party are thinking maybe Netanyahu will retire or will be convicted and they have to get themselves prepared. And Barkat is actually leading the crowd in all internal polls. So, you know, it's interesting because again, as Laser wisely mentioned, the gap between the elite and the people can't be more in front of your eyes.
Okay, well, lots to follow as this week goes on. Thanks to you both for being here today. Appreciate it. Have a good day of reporting and writing.
Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you, Jessica. Good day.
See you tomorrow, everyone.
Hi, it's Sarah Tuttle Singer from The Times of Israel. Come join our community and support fast and fair independent journalism. You can sign up with the link at the bottom of every single article on the site.
Thanks for listening to The Times of Israel Daily Briefing.
You can find us daily wherever you get your podcasts.
And of course, on thetimesofisrael.com.